John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
Well, the wait continues, and boy, there's a lot of twisting things going on in college football. We've got the Pac-12 meeting today, trying to see what they're going to do for the season. The Big Ten, which seemed to be leaning toward shutting everything down this year, now they're reopening their talks today. And ACC, SEC, they are going ahead. So we've got lots to keep up on and hope to get some word as this show goes on about where it's going. A lot of stuff going on in the National Football League, basketball, baseball, you name it. Let's get started with the five biggest stories of the day.
Number one.
Coronavirus hit us in March, right? Early March. It's August 10th. How come there hasn't been more leadership from the top setting up better plans for all of the college football players to feel unified, to feel protected? Why did it take 20-year-old kids to call out the lack of leadership for us to get here? That's a problem. And the players shouldn't have to suffer for that because they're the ones who finally had the courage to do so. So my big issue is the multiple medical experts for different conferences. If there's information that is that important, like an enlarged heart, all the conferences need to know, not just one.
Dan Orlovsky of ESPN talking about what's going on in college football, which is all over the place. And I know in the Big Ten and the Pac-12, they're talking about a heart condition that's coming from the virus, which is the first we've ever heard about this. So that's all new, and apparently it's scary stuff. But you don't hear anything about that nationwide, so everything seems to be at least quietly talked about, but openly talked about in the Big Ten and the Pac-12. And I don't know if the information got to the ACC, SEC. How accurate the information is, who knows it. But I think Dan is right in saying that Larry Scott needs better leadership. Mark Emmert in the NCAA is showing absolutely no leadership. And so where it goes, Bruce Feldman says that the presidents and chancellors of each school expected to vote today on postponing or canceling the season. Doesn't seem to be, very optimistic about that's going. We had more news yesterday. On Monday, the Mountain West Conference announced that it is going to cancel fall sports for 2020. UMass, which is an independent, they've now decided they're not going to play football this year. So we've got lots to get into. And again, hard to read. I mean, again, it seems like the way it's heading right now, there's maybe a little bit more life in the Big Ten. And maybe what they might do is, push things back a little bit. At the moment, you've got the SEC going on the right toward the end of September. Big Ten on their schedule came out, and they have it going pretty much the beginning of September. So we don't know the answers right now. We hope to get some idea as this show goes on. And again, we will talk to Brock Hewitt at 10:30 to see what he's hearing and where this might go.
Number two.
I get the news late that night at like 12 o'clock that I tested positive. I'm kind of concerned, thinking that, I'm going to be quarantined for the next 12 to 14 days. And then come yesterday my test results come back and it's negative. And so how the league is running things is right after you test a positive, you immediately do two tests. If you get two negatives, then it was a false positive test. But if you get one positive out of the next two, then you got to have that 14-day quarantine kind of deal. But it's just been a crazy experience.
That's John Ursua. So unusual story. Seattle was one of six teams that before Ursua didn't have a positive test. Now, is this a false positive? We'll find out probably sometime today because he's 1-for-2 right now. Has one negative test, and he also has one positive test, but is that a false positive? So they're awaiting the word on the third test to see if he's going to be allowed to do things or he's going to have to be quarantined. And so, again, that he's asymptomatic, seems to think that he should be okay, but we can see. And again, what we're seeing so far is that it's been a lot better than I think people thought, because at this stage there have been 107 players who have had a positive test, and literally about 70 of them are all back. We're down to like in the 30s as far as the number that are still sitting out and sitting on the COVID injured list, if you want to call it that. And so, but again, we'll find out about Ursua to see if the Seahawks will have a clean sweep so far as the positives, the positive parts of having negative tests.
Number three.
You'll want Swinging a high fly ball, carrying out to right field. Gallo is back, leaping, gone! Grand slam, Kyle Seager. The fifth of his career, and Kyle Seager brings them all home. He has blown this game open in the sixth inning. It's 9-2 Mariners.
So, big day for the Mariners as they went down to Texas on this eight-game road trip and got a 10-2 victory in the season opener against the Rangers. Kyle Seager, grand slam home run, and they had three total home runs. Kyle Lewis hit a three-run homer. Dylan Moore continues his hot hitting. He had a solo homer in the seventh. And so, with Seager, Lewis, Moore, they went 8-for-14, three homers, and all 10 of the 10 RBIs that came in this game. Justin Dunn gets his first win. Six innings, allowed two runs. Very positive game as the Mariners now go to 7-11 on their record. So that's a very positive thing for this team. Mariners are going to face the Rangers again tonight. Pre-game is going to be at 5 o'clock and the first pitch at 6:05. And you'll be able to hear it on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Number four.
Obviously, it's going to be one of those things, whoever rises to the top the fastest. Which, you know, sometimes doesn't mean you're the best player. Sometimes it just means you grasp the concept quicker, right? And depending upon where you were and if the terminology is the same and if the asks are the same or if you've been coached in a similar fashion, sometimes that guy will excel, you know, beyond the rest of the players, but maybe the other players, given time, will become better. But you're going to have to make decisions. Like, you're going to have to make decisions on rosters without really letting the competition happen.
That's Mark Sloreth talking about this strange season so far where there's not been a padded practice and you got so many roster moves that have been made on players you don't even hardly know. I mean, I know it started out there was about 426 undrafted players. We're now down into like the 331 range. So that means you have about 90-some guys who have never put on a uniform or put on pads that have been with this with their teams and not knowing how good they are or how not. I mean, it's a very unusual thing. But you kind of get the feeling today some roster moves are going to be happening. Yesterday, the Seahawks ended up taking cornerback Byron Allen and running back Anthony Jones and releasing them. They were guys that were on the practice squad. Jones was an undrafted free agent out of Florida International. So now the roster is at 77, and of course that includes John Ursua, who's on the COVID list. And so we'll find out if they make some moves today. And again, you would kind of get the feeling there's going to be a bunch of moves today, because if indeed you have at least the padded practices starting next Monday, I mean, you want the guys in there and trying to go through the five-day period of testing with the COVID and make sure that they're going to be available for putting the pads on for the one of 14 practices on the padded practices that start on Monday. So stay tuned for that. Again, are the Seahawks going to do anything with Clay Matthews? Are they going to do anything with Marcel Darius, a defensive tackle? Are they going to do anything with Everson Griffin? I mean, could one of those moves happen today? You would think if that's of main interest to Seattle, something very well could be coming down the line. And of course, just some moves to fill out that 80-man roster. So stay tuned. We'll keep you on top of what might be happening.
Number five.
An October bubble? A playoff bubble? That seems to be a much more realistic thing for Major League Baseball to embrace. And the idea that amid this second wave that it had been talking about, you know, behind the scenes for months, MLB saying we got to end September 27th, got to end because the second wave is coming. If you're that scared about the second wave, put a bubble together. Do it in L.A. Do it in Texas. Do it in Phoenix. Do it in Florida. Do it anywhere. Do it in Dyersville, Iowa, where the Fields of Dreams game was supposed to be. I don't care. Just get a bubble together if you want the sanctity of October to exist.
Okay, so that's Jeff Passan from ESPN talking about a pretty good idea, you know, baseball in the playoffs going into a bubble, and they can do it in three different areas. I mean, they can do it in Southern California. You can do it in Chicago. You can do it in New York City. And I think that might be better than having, you know, the stadiums open up, particularly now you're talking about late September and October. And one MLB official told ESPN, if you want to make sure you get through October, you really got to get this right. And so far, there's been so many wrongs. You see it with St. Louis. I mean, they've only played about five games. You saw it with the Miami Marlins. They were just brutal. to start out the season. It almost wiped out the season. But I think the idea, as Jeff was saying, of a multi-city bubble looks to be, I think, good. You can see it working in the NHL. You can see it working in the NBA. And again, you're caring about the safety of players. And so now I think if they can do that, and of course the one thing that's good and bad for the players is that if you're in the bubble, you pretty much can't leave it. If you leave it, you leave yourself at risk. We saw one player yesterday who ended up leaving in Cleveland and going out, and so now he had to be quarantined for his next start. And so those things I think you have to keep track of. Hey, listen to the show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we're going to go under further review and talk about what run stuffer should the Seahawks go for, should they go for, and what moves would be the best. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Under further review with John Clayton.
We'll review the play.
News from the Seahawks is a positive one. John Ursua has a negative. So he's had two negatives, and so what it turned out to be over the weekend, he had a false positive, kind of like Matthew Stafford did with the Detroit Lions, and so it looks like he's going to be cleared to be able to play and be able to practice and do all the things that he wants to be able to do and not be quarantined. So now, even though, again, technically, I guess you could say the Seahawks were one of six teams that didn't have a positive test. They did have a positive test, but it turns out to be a false positive. So that's good news for certainly John Ursua, and good news for the Seahawks, and they continue to have nothing but good news. And when, of course, now it's a matter today, there's three roster spots open. Actually, it'll be two now because Ursua will go back on the active roster. Is that, now it's a matter of, okay, what are you going to do with those two spots? Is it going to be a defensive end? Is it going to be a defensive tackle? You know, where's that move going to be? And, I know we've talked so much about the defensive ends. You know, Everson Griffin would seem to be a good fit. Clay Matthews would be able to come in and help out as a Leo, trying to rush the quarterback and do some things there. But defensive tackle, that's going to be another area because they want that run-stopping defensive tackle. Sure, they have the ability to take some of their three techniques and put them in backup roles on nickel and things of that nature, rushing the quarterback and all that. But you've got some names right now. Now, one name they're not going to be able to get is Mike Daniels, who's been to one Pro Bowl. Looks like he's going to sign with the Cincinnati Bengals. All right. Then you have Damon Snacks Harrison, who I think is probably the best choice, and he could be recruited here by all the players from Detroit that all pretty much got out of Detroit and probably wanted to get out of Detroit. He wanted to get out of Detroit because it didn't seem to mesh with Matt Patricia. But Damon Snacks Harrison is also trying to decide, is it worth it to be able to play this year? And so that's going to be up for bid to try to talk about that. Then Marcel Darius could be a candidate. He's a good one. Then you got Tim Jernigan, who had signed with Houston, but they backed out of the deal, the Texans did, and so he's become available. So now, which fit could it be? Let's go to Jake Heaps and see what he thinks.
On Friday, there was a tweet from Adam Kaplan saying that the Seahawks may or may not have been linked to free agent defensive tackle Marcel Darius. You want to see him in Seattle?
Marcel Darius is one of the four defensive tackles that I have mentioned repeatedly that I think would be a really good fit here in Seattle. Now, Darius, coming off of this last season, to me was definitely concerning. He only played six games in 2019, had a core muscle injury that gave him issues, and so that's something that you have to keep your eye on. But if the medical staff and the Seahawks are feeling good about where he's at, traditionally, he's been a very good, productive player in this league who's been a tremendous run stuffer. So for Marcel Darius, I personally would love to see Damon Snacks Harrison. He would be my number one guy if I had to choose. But I think Marcel Darius would bring veteran depth, and it would boost Puna Ford and Jaron Reed, in my opinion, just so those guys don't have the burden of responsibility all on their shoulders, because that is the case right now. You look at their defensive tackle position right now, Puna Ford, Jaron Reed, DeMarcus Christmas, Brian Monet, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who the other guy is, but that's also because it's not a proven player who's played very much in this league. So it's a scary position when you look at the overall depth.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, they've been looking now for some time, and, you know, with the fact that they've got a couple roster spots, they made a couple moves yesterday to open up the roster spots, you kind of get the feeling that something might happen. Now, will it be a defensive tackle? Will it be a defensive end? What position will it be? And again, you'd like to be able to make that move today or tomorrow, so at least you have the 5 days where you can get the COVID test and, you know, get that through. And because, again, you tested the first day, you get tested the fourth day, and then if you get, you have to wait a day to see if you can pass the test, and which, of course, we just saw with John Ursua, is that he took his test and then failed it the first time and then got two negatives, and he's been able to go. But I think right now that, you know, I'm just kind of anxious because this is a day, particularly with most teams having padded practices starting Monday, and you really don't want to lose the chance to have a new player, you know, pick up things and then go on the field, and you want him to go through some virtual meetings and understand some things. So, I agree with Jake. I think the best fit would be Damon Snacks Harrison, you know, big defensive tackle. Question's going to be how much is he going to want? You know, the team's pretty well moved away from the big ticket item of Jadeveon Clowney because he's not brought his demands down. In fact, I think he's even increased them. So that's out. And so I kind of think Snacks would be the guy, but also as big as he is, I think you can see with all the defensive tackles that opted out this year, including three starters, that there's a concern if you're a 300-pound guy, you know, do you really want to risk doing it? So Curtis Rogers, I mean, what do you think today's going to be a move on one of these veterans? Darius, of course, would be a great fit too, Pro Bowl-type player. I mean, one point was one of the highest-paid defensive tackles in football.
Yeah, and I mean, with the release of those two guys on the practice squad, the running back Anthony Jones and then the cornerback Brian Allen, I mean, it does kind of speak to the Seahawks maybe greasing the wheels on a move, whether it be on the defensive line or something else, because they've got those open roster spots. They've got three of them, and I know they like to keep about one open just in case, you know, they need to grab somebody in an emergency. They've kind of been at like 79 for the majority of training camp so far, but, you know, three open roster spots, that's some competition right there if they want to bring in somebody. And I would hope that they're looking defensive line right now. That seems to be the spot that everybody looks at right now and says that's the biggest hole on the Seahawks defense. But also, John, what if it means Josh Gordon and they're expecting a decision on him soon? That can free up a roster spot for him. So there are plenty of options right now. If it came down to signing a free agent defensive tackle or bringing in Josh Gordon right away, what do you think the Seahawks would prioritize right now? I tend to think it would be bringing in Josh Gordon just so, A, they can have another weapon for us to use, and then, B, keep him out of the hands of any other team.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, has he had enough time with test to be able to at least satisfy the commissioner and satisfy the National Football League that he can be available? So that's still to be determined. Of course, he, Randy Gregory, you know, waiting for a ruling. Gregory, of course, has tweeted out several times, you know, how frustrated he is waiting for that. I mean, he wants to find out as quickly as he can so he can get to a camp and get going. Because, you know, it's like, again, it's not like a normal time where you can go ahead and, you know, just call somebody up, bring them in and sign them and get them on the field the next day. It's a 5-day wait. And of course, I mean, we're almost at the deadline right now for what you need to do, because, again, if you can't get it done, then what ends up happening is that, you know, you start missing padded practices and you go into the season pretty cold.
Yeah, and you don't want that at all. I look at the defensive line right now, John, and I think I'm starting to convince myself that the pass rush is going to be what it is, and I think they can really add to the defensive line by going with a run stuffer. I don't see them going after anybody big in terms of pass rushing. Maybe Everson Griffin, if the numbers work out, you know, between him and the Seahawks, or maybe Clay Matthews. But I don't think it's going to get any bigger or better than that. So I think the best way they can improve that defensive line is finding somebody to fit that Al Woods mold, fit that, you know, Clinton McDonald mold, the Tony McDaniel, the guy who's just going to command double teams and free up everybody else, because I don't know if the help is on the way for the pass rush. And I actually, for as much as I've wanted the Seahawks to go get Jadeveon Clowney this offseason, I'm starting to warm to the idea of a rotation of Collier and Irvin and also Daryl Taylor and Benson Mayowa. I don't know if it's necessarily the 32nd ranked group, as I think Pro Football Focus put them a few weeks back, but I guess I'm warming up to it. How do you feel about this pass rushing group?
I mean, it'd be nice to add one more because Griffin, I think, is the better fit. You know, what I'm wondering about, if you bring Clay Matthews in, and I think there's maybe a preference for Clay because he's been such a great player, maybe even a Hall of Fame player through all these years. But you've got, four Leo types. That'd be five Leo types. And it's almost like too much. Like in the case of Griffin, maybe you can put him at the Leo on first down and, have L.J. Collier there. But really, Griffin's more the insurance policy, because if Collier's not there to be a starter, if you got Rasheem Green not there to be a starter, and I know you can probably put Green over maybe at a Leo too, but you have flexibility. But, it'd be nice to be able to do it. And, of course, I mean, you can still fill some void right now at defensive tackle because, I mean, you can take Collier, you can take, Brandon Jackson and that, and you can play them at defensive tackle when needed, because, again, your two starters are going to be Jaron Reed, who's going to be, pretty much playing 85% of the time, and then you're also going to have Puna Ford, who probably be, just on mostly the running plays, but he also has a little bit of a pass rush last year. But of course, they had very little of the pass rush last year. Hey, tell your smart speaker to play 710 ESPN Seattle. Remember, you can always listen on 710 to your smart speaker or your app. Coming up next, we'll talk college and Seahawks with Brock Heward, John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, lots going on in college football, lots going on in NFL football, and who better to talk about both and Brock Heward. And Brock, I haven't talked to you in ages. How you been?
What's going on, JC? It's been too long.
I know.
Yeah, we're doing good. It is crazy times. It's this last 5-6 days, just the spin of emotions, where a week ago I was talking to a lot of my colleagues and some of my folks at the networks, and oh my gosh, all these conferences can play all these conference only games, and look at this schedule, it's going to be unbelievable, and they're going to play on Thursdays and Fridays and Saturdays, and there's no cream puffs. It's all just incredible conference play. And then over the weekend, I'm getting lots of notes from friends like, are you hearing what I'm hearing, that this is like 95% done and the season's shut down? And then you see the huge outpouring from players and coaches and administrators saying, hey, give us a chance. Just put this on pause. As we've been at this for 6, 7, 8 weeks on many of these campuses, John, as Jim Harbaugh wrote about, I've got a brother at a Power 5 school. I've got friends at other Power 5 schools. It's not as if these kids got there this week. I mean, they have been training and making decisions for 6, 7, 8 weeks at some of these schools. So, and I think that has at least put some of the decisions that were to be made on Sunday on pause to possibly reconsider, to maybe gather more information, let these experts have more time and more information to gather and before you completely pull the plug on everything.
Yeah, because, I mean, yesterday it seemed gloom and doom, with the Big Ten. The vote technically was Sunday night.
Yeah.
Where 12 out of the 14 presidents says, nope, no season this year. And then, I guess, with not the threat, but with Nebraska coming out and their coach saying, hey, we may go to another conference, we may go someplace else. You got Michigan, Ohio State, they're not happy with things. So I guess there's a reconsideration. And then you've got the Pac-12, and I don't know, what kind of feel do you have for the Pac-12? The one thing I'm kind of wondering about is that, they talked about, in both the Big Ten and I guess the Pac-12, about this heart condition. Well, I've watched, CNN and all the news channels as probably more than anybody else, and I've never heard anything about this heart thing that has been involved. What is that?
Yeah, myocarditis. Yeah, I think they've had 5 players at some of the different schools. Now, remember, that is something that is treatable. There's lots of other viruses that can bring that about as well, and if detected early enough, it's 100%. From the doctors that I've talked to, said, no, it's 100% treatable. But, it's just the unknown, John. That's what it is. This is all about still the unknown. And I would think, if you're going to ask me, what do I think is going to happen? I think the Pac-12 will either today postpone or just outright cancel the season, because that has been the approach out west. That's been the approach in California and Oregon and Washington with online schools, and it's been their approach through this entire virus and how they've handled it compared to lots of other places. So I think they'll be the first to either postpone it, at best delay it, but I think going to postpone it. And then it will be fascinating to see, because the ACC, the SEC, the Big 12 have not gone down that road. The Big 10 did, as you alluded to, on Sunday night. Some of its members have come out and said, whoa, 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 give us a chance. Kirk Herbstreit, who's connected to is as connected as anybody, especially in that conference, you know, put out a tweet last night saying this is not to cancel the season. It's to delay it. Can they push it back to an October start so they can see, as college kids come back to campus, as they try to mitigate this virus and live with this virus? And how can you do that? And how can the athletes do it with the student body? You know, I've got a friend of mine that's driving to Oklahoma with their daughter today, who's going to begin school down there. What does all of that look like over the weeks ahead? And I think all the while, allow them, as Scott Frost said, to continue to practice. As the Wake Forest coach said, continue to practice. As the Tennessee chancellor was out on the field with their team, and let them continue to prove that they can make grown-up choices. That's what the players want. You know, this entire movement to me is about these players saying, hey, we have been on campus for 7 or 8 weeks. We're not all getting in big groups. We're not going to the bars. Give us the chance to show we can be responsible enough, as all these pro athletes are across all these different sports largely. It's not every one of them, and some of them have had outbreaks and made mistakes and everything else, but largely overall, the numbers have been fairly positive. I think that's what these players are clamoring for, and we'll see whether or not the decision makers give them time and continue time to delay the process.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, it seems like it's all go ahead for the SEC and the ACC, even though some of their schools are in really bad states. I mean, Georgia being bad, Florida being bad. I mean, they're all going to go, it looks like.
Yeah, and the Sun Belt and Conference USA, and as I said, Big 12 and Oklahoma and Oklahoma State and Texas and all of them. And, you know, you can just look at the approach that those states have taken through this, you know, with their governors and with their leadership versus the approach in Michigan versus the approach in California versus the approach in Montana. Like, you know, I mean, it's just the handling of this and the leadership. And it's why, John, I don't envy any of these decision makers. I've talked to and been texting with some of the different ADs around the country that I've gotten to know over the years. And, you know, this has been the hardest 6 months for them that any of them have ever endured. Truly, I believe that the majority of these ADs want the best for their players. They really do. They know they're the lifeblood of their programs. They want to look out for them. They want what's best for them. And ultimately, you know, who is going to call the shots? Is it going to be the medical folks? Well, John, I don't know. You bring together 10 medical people and you tell me if all 10 are on the exact same page, right? I mean, that also is an enormous challenge of how they look at the data and what they see and how they project and where this thing is going. So there is massive unknown. There is massive liability. There could be massive litigation. I mean, there are just massive, massive issues, which is why I think you felt what you felt over the weekend. I think you've seen an outpouring from the college football players and coaches and staffs and even administrators to say, let's just give this some more time before we completely pull the plug so we can continue to learn through the process.
I know you had Bruce Feldman on the podcast. What kind of things did he kind of bring up from behind the scenes?
Yeah, he feels as I do, John, that the college football landscape, however this season unfolds, it's going to look very, very different in the years to come. You know, if we would have had this chat a year ago before any of this, I would have said to you, John, I think in my lifetime, whatever my days are, I'm pretty confident that the college football landscape that we've watched for 3 or 4 decades is going to be very different in the next couple decades. The haves and the have-nots is being further distinguished. The playing field is not level. You have the Power Five schools, the Group of Five schools, the FCS level schools. Their amount of resources are entirely different. And I think this will just only expedite some of that change that's going to be coming. I don't think you're going to see massive reconstruction of Nebraska just totally vacating everything in their conference to just play as Renegades or Independents. You know, I think there's a lot of talk, But I think ultimately, you know, in the years to come, we're going to see three or four power super conferences. These Power Five schools largely, I think, just differentiate themselves because the resources they have and the money that they create and the revenue they generate is just so entirely different than many of their peers.
No doubt. What kind of damage do you think this does to the Husky program, you know, sitting out the season?
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's been a challenge for all of these schools out west as the Big Ten and even the SEC has come in and taken their own. You know, the top two quarterbacks in the state of California this last recruiting cycle, John, who come from two powerhouse programs that have traditionally tied into USC and UCLA and Stanford. Well, they're going to Clemson and Alabama. And that was, you know, a red flag last year. And if those conferences go on and play and they go on and find success and they go on and get all the exposure and they go on and move on, you know how this works in the perception world that is recruiting. That's not going to benefit anybody out west.
No, that's true. What about the players that might opt out? I know that there's been a little bit more in the ACC opting out than the SEC, and you know that Nick Saban would stomp the foot on anybody. Because I was counting up the other day what I had, eight Alabama players going in the first three rounds looking at different mock drafts, which is more than anybody else. But you get the idea that you could see one of two things. Somebody maybe transferring to Alabama or the SEC school or wherever, or just opting out and just getting ready for the NFL draft.
I mean, that's just the reality down there, right? Is yes, Nick Saban is much more of a dictator than any of these schools see out west. But when you put 7, 8, 10 guys in the league year after year after year after year, and oh, by the way, win a national championship every other year. Yeah, there's kind of, when he says this is the way we're going to do it, this is the way to do it, there's a lot of kids that go, yeah, because they've seen all their peers make it to the league. They've seen their lives change. They've seen generational money change in those homes, and they've won a lot of football games along the way. So, yeah, it's a different methodology than many of the folks practice out west, but, man, the results for those student-athletes has been hugely beneficial.
No doubt. So, Brock, great to talk to you. Hope to see you at some point. That's the thing is, like in this pandemic, we don't get to see hardly anybody.
It is so weird, man. It is so weird. So hopefully, yes, we can all get together and maybe we'll jump on and talk a little NFL next time too, John. Well, appreciate it, man.
I know sometime next week we'll get together for 2-a-days.
Yes, we do. We get a fun little roundtable, I think, next Tuesday, you and me for an hour.
Well,
I look forward to that.
Okay. Thank you, Brock Huert. Hey, by the way, Seahawk Training Camp is here, and it's time for 2-a-days on 710 ESPN Seattle, starting August the 7th. Join us each weekday for exclusive access to a training camp with its daily roundtable from 11 a.m. to noon, featuring myself, Brock Huert, and the other NFL experts on the Seahawks. They'll give you a chance to interact also, here's what's also in addition to this, with 710 hosts on a live video chat each afternoon at 710sports.com. 710 ESPN Seattle is your all access to Seahawks training camp with 2-a-days starting August 17th. Coming up next, we'll catch up on the NFL Behind the Lines next.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And, of course, still waiting to see what news. I mean, the only thing so far we're hearing this morning is that one of the ACC medical people came out and says, yes, you can play football this year. And, of course, that's being countered by some of the Pac-12 medical people saying, no, it's not advisable to do it. And then you have others that are kind of chiming in on the Big Ten and all that. So it's a very messy situation. No guidance from the NCAA. They're basically having everybody kind of do their own thing, which, of course, is I guess par for the course right now, because you know there's more power at the athletic director's position, particularly in SEC schools and maybe ACC schools, and maybe that you have for Mark Emmert. But it's a messy situation. Now we'll have to see where the momentum is swinging. You know, will the Big Ten, even though the president's voted 12-2 to move to not have the season this year, and naturally you're going to have the National Football League looking at this, because you know they then can try to see if they can claim some financial property, because you know they're going to stand off if the college football has their Saturdays, and you know the colleges, SEC and ACC, know that. That's why they're pushing so strong to keep their TV contracts. And then I don't know where it stands nationwide as far as high school football. But if there's no high school football, I guess then there's an outside chance that maybe the NFL will try to claim some Friday night games and flex those games. But I don't know, Curtis. I mean, we've watched baseball in the chaotic situation that it is. Now it's almost topped by college football.
Yeah, I think this especially the craziness of college football here. This has been a much bigger, I guess, firestorm in a way. Baseball's was more drawn out. This is much more, you know, over the course of about a week or so, we've seen it kind of explode on us here. And all college sports fans, all sports fans really, are just trying to kind of piece together how each and everything is working out right now across college football. It doesn't help that all these leagues have different ways of going about this, especially when they're quote-unquote under the guidance of the NCAA, which has not guided anybody on anything yet. They've kind of left everybody up to their own devices here. So it's just going to be crazy to see the results of these meetings between the university presidents and the coaches and the athletic directors and Larry Scott, and how all of these things will work themselves out tonight or later this afternoon, whoever. No word on when this decision is going to come down, but, you know, judging from what we heard with Brock just a moment ago, I mean, I would not expect Pac-12 football to be played in the fall this year, and if it does get played, it will be in the springtime. At least that's from, you know, everything that we've gathered over the last couple of days. It just seems like that's going to be the best case scenario for us.
Yeah, no doubt. And it is just so frustrating to see that it's almost as if there's been no plan. I mean, everybody's kind of on their own.
Agreed.
Trying to figure this out.
Yeah, it just seems as though everything is just kind of everybody's flying by the seat of their pants. They're reacting when news hits rather than being proactive about it. We did see, though, yesterday the SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey say they're going to wait until September 26, which I think was smart of them to delay their season further than everybody else, because you know, that gives them an extra month and a half before they have to figure anything out. But still, you know, the less you figure out now, the more you're going to have to figure out once the time comes for games to get started. I think that's why the Pac-12 and the Big Ten are in this mode right now, because their schedules were slated to begin at the end of August and the start of September. We're just a couple weeks away from that possibility.
Yeah, but it is just so wild. But and yet, I mean, you look at the NFL, I think you have to say it's, you know, going pretty smoothly so far. I mean, you look, there's been 107 tests, and by my count, there's been 74 that have now gone back on the field. So there's only like about 33 players who are left that, you know, have positive tests. And now you can see that John Ursua was able to be cleared because he had a false positive over the weekend, and then he's come back and had two negatives after that. So it looks like that's okay. But when you think about, I mean, here it is, you know, some of the worst times. I mean, I contend now, The virus is worse now than when it started because of the poor way the country's handled it with no guidance. And nevertheless, I mean, you know, I thought there'd be like 140 players that are going to test positive, and so far it's 107, and we have still more tests coming back. But to think that here it is, you know, the second week of August, and only 33 players are pretty much in quarantine, that's not bad.
Yeah, and I think a good thing to watch for here is how many players will test positive once these guys are out of quarantine and once they're, you know, practicing to their fullest capabilities. We've kind of seen each team, or at least a lot of teams, kind of create their own bubble atmosphere. Pete Carroll talked about that a little bit. You know, we've also seen the Saints talk about creating their own bubble atmosphere. Hopefully these NFL guys are a little more vigilant than what we've seen in Major League Baseball, especially with like the Cleveland Indians over the last couple of days, getting two pitchers now sent home because of them breaking protocol, breaking quarantine. You know, it's just such a wild time that, you know, being young, you do kind of feel a little invincible because of, you know, how quickly young people heal up, speaking as somebody who's under the age of 30, but you know, you got to be mindful of those around you, and hopefully these guys are able to you know, keep it locked down during the time they're with their teammates. John, also in the NFL world, Daniel Snyder, who has had maybe the worst offseason of his career, he is now trying to file a lawsuit against a former Washington football team executive assistant who he claims received money to help spread damaging information about Snyder. Is this in response to the Washington Post article, or is this a completely separate issue?
It's a completely separate issue. It's a I think it's a publication It's a publication in the Mideast. I can't remember exactly where exactly that is coming from, but apparently they're saying that, you know, he had some nasties with this woman, and, you know, I guess that the woman now he's suing is one who used to work there that was gathering some information and giving it to the Mideast person and who is writing this stuff. And so, yeah, it's like I guess he's being as aggressive as he possibly can to make sure his name doesn't get muddied after, you know, so far the name's getting muddied, and how in the meantime there's story now starting to come out and rumblings with some of the things that's being tweeted on the Washington football team's website that maybe they might be coming close to having a name.
Interesting. I know they were coming close yesterday to figuring out like a new team motto, new team hashtag or whatever, but it would be interesting to see if they, you know, got the name out a year in advance of when they said they were going to, because I think they had postponed it, what, till 2021?
Mm-hmm, right. They said it could take as much as 18 months.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
I mean, yeah, it's a name. Like, you figure it out. It's not that hard.
Yeah, and from what the rumblings seem to be, one name that we hadn't really thought of that it could end up being is Red Wolves.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so Red Wolf seems to be one of the new names that's juggling around and could be a possibility.
I could see that working.
Yeah. Because, again, I guess the big thing that they want to maintain is the color scheme of their uniform and the color scheme of their motto. And so red seems to be, you know, now one of the priorities. And so, you know, they're not going for the Tuskegees or, wherever, but I think at the moment it could lean toward Red Wolves. But stay tuned on that front. Hey, be sure to check out the Professor's Notes on 710sports.com. The Professor's Notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma Advice. Coming up next, we talk to Jake Heaps. With all the stuff going on with the Seahawks, John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.